You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is back open for live shows, classes, and customized corporate workshops and events. But we also have all those things available in virtual formats. For more information, go to secondcity.com. The Second City is excited to work with Amazon as part of their new and exciting app called AMP. AMP is a home where anyone can create live radio-style shows alongside some of the biggest names in the entertainment industry, including ours. Join the Second City live every Thursday at 5 p.m. Central Time for our show, Second City Public Radio. SCPR is an interactive weekly lampoon of all things public radio. Each week, our host and an ever-expanding panel of Second City characters open up the lines to listeners from around the U.S. to ask questions and offer us opinions on a slew of wide-reaching subjects. Download the app and don't forget to tune in, AMP, Thursdays at 5 p.m. Central Time. Today's pod is with Brian Wong, who is an entrepreneur and evangelist of the digital economy. He was the 52nd employee of Alibaba and the first American. He has a new book. It's called The Tao of Alibaba, Inside the Chinese Digital Giant That is Changing the World. Enjoy the pod. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at The Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job. At the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Brian Wong, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, Kelly.
So I mostly don't know how many of my guests who we bring to the podcast are familiar with the improv concept of yes and. But it appears that you might be, or at least tangentially, because you write about Savio Kwan, who was Alibaba's COO, introducing the company to his yes theory, which sounded a lot like yes and.
Yeah. You picked that up. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I think the site that or the text that you're citing is really when we're talking about Savio Kwan's management approach. And it also relates to kind of this concept of the Tao within Alibaba. And I think most people tend to think of decisions as binary, yes and no. Yep. And he really says it's yes and yes. And the idea behind that is life is really about yes and yes. It's never one or the other. And it's really about how you calibrate or balance those decisions in life and in business, how you make those decisions. And so I think it's the reason why I use the analogy of Tao in the book is really to show that it's really not black and white, it's shades of gray. And we have to sort of be able to embrace that, this duality, so to speak. And that happens to be a very key tenet of a Chinese philosophical approach. So, you know, as an American that went to work for that company, Alibaba, for me, it actually took some adjusting. You know, I'm obviously my last name is Wong. I grew up in California. However, like I've been in America, my family about 100 years. So for me, it was also a cultural sort of awakening that, you know, the way that one looks at the world, sometimes you have to put it in the cultural context to really grasp what is happening.
Yeah. Cause it's, A, easier just to think in terms of black and white. You know, our brains are, we're storytelling machines. We like to make patterns, but that also doesn't get us necessarily to the truth. And I think the thing that's sort of fascinating about this book, The Story of This Company, is this philosophy, which really feels like it comes out of Jack Ma, right? I mean, he's where this begins. So tell us a little bit about like how you met him and who Jack Ma is.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jack is obviously the founder of Alibaba, but his background is really as a teacher. He, you know, he started his career as an English teacher in China, and he sort of stumbled, I guess, onto business because as a teacher, he also became a translator, and as a translator, he started to get involved in sort of representing sort of trade delegations that were going abroad to the United States, and that's when he discovered the internet. And there's a great story behind that because he was trying to recoup some investment that a Chinese company had lost to a U.S. investor, and that investor technically held him hostage in Nevada, and he escaped and he went to a casino and gambled enough money to buy a plane ticket to Seattle, which was the only city in America that he knew someone. Mm-hmm. And that's where he discovered the internet. And you know, for me, I met Jack actually in California in 1999 when he was trying to raise funds for Alibaba. I guess he met like 32 venture capitalists and didn't raise a single dime on that trip. Mm-hmm. But I was fortunate enough to meet him. And one thing that really struck me when I met him, and I was introduced to a friend that was actually serving as his CFO at the time. And what struck me was Jack's vision for what he wanted to do with technology, but for an emerging market that clearly had great potential, but really people didn't feel that it was a good time to be trying to do internet businesses in that country.
There's a great quote you've got from him where he says, Alibaba succeeded because one, we had no plan, two, no technology, and three, no money. So I think, again, most people will be like, well, that doesn't seem like a plus. But in fact, when you're navigating complexity, sometimes having that like blank slate is the advantage.
Absolutely. You know, again, Jack sort of talks in riddles, and most people were scratching their head when he made that statement. I think it was at a Harvard Business School conference. And when you hear it, you're like, well, how do I interpret this? And really what Jack was saying is, no business plan means that, you know, we're adaptable, we're willing to change when we need to. We're not going to lock ourselves into one way of doing things. No money really meant that they had to use the limited resources that they had in order to achieve the goals that they were. And so that actually forces you to be more creative mm-hmm. in the way you do business. And then no technology really refers to the fact that Jack was not a technologist. He was, like I said, an English teacher. But what he did understand was the need that existed in the market, and he trusted his technology team enough to kind of make the decisions necessary to try and provide solutions using the tools that they had to address those problems. And in some ways, if you think about a lot of the standard sort of, you know, internet founders, they often have technical backgrounds, but because they understand so much about that, they end up micromanaging it to the point where they don't allow for that level of creativity to happen.
So the biggest revelation for me in this book, and I think it's tied to that, is this idea of one of the ways Alibaba succeeded was because in China, let's say in the late 90s, there weren't things like shopping centers all over the place. So talk to us a bit about paint the picture of China in the late 90s and then how Alibaba sort of took advantage of that with this technology.
So that's a good point, Kelly. I mean, China in the 90s had very little in the way of legacy or let's just say existing kind of retail infrastructure. It had very little in the way of kind of financial services. Very different from what we have here in the U.S. at that time. And what Jack liked to say is that in America, e-commerce is the dessert, and in China, e-commerce is the main course.
Right.
And what he meant by that is that, you know, because there was nothing existing at that time in the retail and payment side, what they created through the e-commerce platforms that they built and the payment systems really became the main method by which people, you know, purchased and consumed things because there was nothing prior to that. When I lived in Hangzhou in the late 1990s, I remember just trying to find a box of Quaker Oats oatmeal uh-huh. was like a huge task because, you know, nobody sold that stuff. I mean, as a Californian, I'm trying to be healthy and, you know, find the really mm-hmm. good stuff. And is nowhere to be found. Even something like Oreo cookies was considered like a nice thing to have because it was you know an American product. So if you think about kind of the infrastructure that existed back then, e-commerce was very much a revolutionary thing because you can find all the products from all over the world that were not available in the standard retail markets.
This might be a good opportunity to sort of have you explain what Alibaba is for our listeners who don't know. I just realized we hadn't covered that.
Well, Alibaba, most people know it as sort of an e-commerce company, akin to, say, an eBay or an Amazon. And it actually is both of those. But it's also a PayPal. It's also, you could say it's a Google, it's a Facebook, it's a YouTube, all combined into one. Mm-hmm. Mainly because the way that this platform sort of evolved and emerged was really to kind of meet the needs of society at that time. And so it started out as a B2B kind of wholesale marketplace, but then it evolved into consumer retail. It also created a payment system. It has cloud computing, and it has a logistics network, and it also has an entertainment platform and a health platform. Like, I can go on and on because it's continued to expand, yeah. But that's really been based on how the consumer market kind of evolved in terms of their needs.
And then one of the things that it did sort of incredibly, and I think this is a good for society, is sort of connecting these rural communities to a world that just they had no connection to, right?
Yes. So, I mean, what happened after, sort of this ecosystem was created kind of for the urban consumers, and essentially you could find virtually anything from around the world on this, what they call the Taobao marketplace, similar to eBay, and then later something called Tmall, which was very similar to Amazon. But this phenomenon started to occur where you saw villages actually starting to connect to e-commerce, first in terms of purchasing things and then in terms of selling things. Mm-hmm. And they were selling things to the urban consumers themselves. And we as an Alibaba at that time discovered Taobao villages, this phenomenon starting in, I think, 2009. And it was really kind of an organic thing where a young person from the village would go to the city and study and get exposed to kind of, you know, these e-commerce services and whatnot, and then return home to the village and then start a business within the village. And there are a number of cases, like there was a town called Shaji in Jiangsu province, where this young man actually started a DIY furniture business, much similar to like IKEA. Mm-hmm. And that business grew from one to thousands of shops over a number of years because he had so much success in terms of selling this DIY furniture. And his neighbors noticed. And they started to get in on the game. Then you started to have ancillary services like web design, logistics, packaging, shipping. And so you had a whole cluster ecosystem that was formed around this. Today I think it employs maybe 23,000 people in terms of that cluster in the township. And they do, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in turnover. And this is one of, I think, close to 5,000-6,000 of these Taobao villages now that have evolved and emerged over the last, I would say, 10 years. And so, Kelly, you're right. I mean, what has happened is it's plugged the rural community into this mainstream economy and provided jobs that were not possible before if you stayed in the villages. Hmm. And it's allowed people to stay, yeah, and do this kind of commerce.
So kind of at the heart of this book to me is the values of Alibaba. And I'd love to go through those because I think they're really interesting and is really the DAO of Alibaba. So the first one is customers first, employees second, shareholders third. I think in America, it would go shareholders first, customers second, employees third is my guess. How about you?
Yeah, I could see that. Mm-hmm. So this is something that Jack has he's always said since, you know, really the early days of the company, and it's something that they've continued to really believe in. And really the logic behind that is obviously it's the customers that are the most important. They constitute the business. And if you can satisfy the customer needs and the pain points, then obviously you're going to feel satisfaction from your job as an employee. Mm-hmm. You're going to feel driven and feel like you're making impact. And then you're going to do an even better job. And then that's going to then impact, you know, the performance of the company. And so that's really the thought behind that. And you're right. It sounded like blasphemy many years ago, but I feel like today attitudes are sort of changing.
Sure, because when you put the share, I mean, we see when you put the shareholders first, and then, you know, your ethics is a thing, cutting corners is a thing, a shortcut to profit is a thing. And I think, okay, so number two, of course, is trust makes everything simple. And I think that speaks to that. That speaks to why maybe shareholders are third, because let's just, if trust, we don't have to worry about it. We don't have to sweat a lot of the hard stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we take for granted how important trust is in terms of facilitating engagements, transactions. I think, you know, we see it in our modern society today, what we read in the media, how we interact with friends. You know, there's certain things that are just given if you have that trust. If you don't have the trust, everything falls apart.
Yeah.
And I think that what, you know, Alibaba, what we tried to do in the early days establish and maintain that trust. So that regardless of the size of the company that was on the platform or the consumers that were, buying from the platform, there was this sense of assurance that what they were getting was what they were expecting, that the payments were going to end up where they needed to go. And, one of the things I think is very interesting about the company in the early days is not only did we take these values and really emphasize them internally to the staff and employees. I remember in the early days, I would go out to many of these towns and run these workshops and share the management principles at Alibaba externally to the business owners and the merchants. And I thought that was a bit strange. Like, why are we spending so much time sharing our internal values and management system to our customers? I think that's about transparency. I think it's also about them trying to understand who we are as an organization and how we think. And then allowing them to kind of sort of understand what's inside this organization that they're putting so much, relying so much on for their own business, success.
We had a scientist on the podcast who studies human beings' love of things, which is a thing. But I think part of that is also we love certain products and we identify character, we give them sort of human characteristics. And I think so part of what's going on there too is you're presenting this sort of transparent, your philosophy as a way for people to then, be loyal to the product. So, and so the third value is change is the only constant, which is, I think just such a interesting. So was that were these values like in the early 90s, right when you started? It changed right over time? Stuff got added, or
it changed. To be honest, so this is the third iteration of the company values, but there's a lot of common threads. Change is the only constant is an evolution of one value that was called embrace change. So it's not that different, except that I think it just makes it more definitive in terms of this is something that will be here forever, and. You know, I mean, in the early internet days, everything was kind of like just on fire and just upside down. And I think that the feeling is that you have to always have that mindset that you got to be ready for this volatility, this uncertainty. And that's why, it is a constant. And I think that's also a key to conditioning people to be willing to accept rapid changes in volatility within a business, because you've already been warned. Change is the only constant.
It's grittier than embracing change. I think it's. Yeah. I imagine you getting kicked around a little bit. You're like, all right, let's make this a little, a little harder because it's going to be.
Yeah.
The fourth is today's best performance is tomorrow's baseline. That's interesting.
Yeah. I think some people feel like you're changing the goalpost, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, hey, I just achieved my goals, and now you're kind of, you know, you're shifting the measurements. Look, again, we all know that the internet space is so competitive, and the rate of growth, the rate of change is so extreme. And I think it was really intended to say that while we reward for good performance and contribution, be ready for the next challenge. And I think that in a lot of ways that's just a realistic expectation if we want to stay competitive and survive. And again, it's kind of putting it out there as you, let's say you join the company and we say, here are our six values. It's like, whoa, okay, am I ready for this? Is that, mm-hmm. is this what I'm going to have to, you know, take on? But the truth of the matter is it pushed people to really achieve great things. I remember so many times where we had what we call stretch goals that seemed humanly impossible, but we achieved them because there was this spirit of, you know, we can do it and we'll come together and make it possible.
So number five is, if not now, when? If not me, who? That's a good one. That feels, I think, you know, we might call that a bias for action.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so this, a lot of these phrases you asked, you know, were these values always here? A lot of these that we took were from the early days of the company. We call them sort of Alibaba's, I mean, famous sayings. And mm-hmm. we took them in their entirety because we felt in the past we just had one word descriptions of values. And this was really kind of taking the whole phrase to capture the essence. And if not now, when? If not me, then who? Was actually the first English phrase we used in our first classified job ad for the company in 1999.
Wow.
And like you said, it is it transmits a sense of urgency and a sense of ownership. Like,
yeah.
Okay, if I don't do it now, then when am I going to do it? And then if it's not me, then who else is going to step up? Mm-hmm. And I think that if that resonates with the reader or the person that sees it, then it means that it's something that they can relate to. It activates something within them.
Okay, and this last one, I think we can get a little deep on, which is number six, live seriously, work happily.
All so right, again, doesn't it sound like it should be the other way around?
Yes, it does. Totally sounds like it should be the other way around.
And I think especially like the international staff, they'd read this and they're like, what the heck are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Like, and really the message here is think very, you know, deliberately about what kind of life you want to live. What does that look like? What does it entail? And then find a vocation that will help achieve that kind of life you want. And if you do that, then you're going to have great enjoyment in the work that you do. It's not going to be a job. It's going to be a passion or pursuit. And I thought that's a very clever value, the way it's phrased, because I think it's, like you said, it's very philosophical, but it says a lot if you really go deep into it.
Yeah, I mean, we had a happiness expert on who talked about if you want to be happy, pay attention to what you're paying attention to. And so I think this idea of understanding we have this one brief short life. So what are we paying attention to? And since work dominates so many hours that we have in a day, make sure you're doing something that, you know, is meaningful to you, that pleases you, that is not too easy and not so difficult that you're not going to achieve anything in it. And that's I don't think any of us were brought up to think that. We're always sort of thinking the other way.
Absolutely. I've got another one for you that's a bit controversial. I wonder what you would say to this.
Okay.
But at Alibaba, we sometimes say that life is work and work is life. Mm-hmm. Just and you know, I think that'd be very controversial in these days because everyone talks about work-life balance. But I think that the essence here again is if you find something that really fits into that, you know, the kind of purpose that you're pursuing, then it's less about the job and more about achieving or pursuing that you know, what's important to you in life. But also there's a belief that when you work, you're learning things that can be applied to your everyday life. And in life, there are things that can be applied to your everyday work. So it's not to say that you shouldn't have time for your family or do the things that are important. But I think that if you compartmentalize, as opposed to kind of see how those two elements sort of fit together, you're actually depriving yourselves of great lessons and kind of wisdom that can enhance the other side.
Yeah, I think a constant on here is that work-life balance is not a thing. Like it's impossible. There's just no, it's impossible. We've had guests who've talked about work-life sway. Some people kind of like that.
Okay.
Work-life integration. But you know, and again, like I'm the worst with this because like I love my job so much. I met my wife here. My kids studied here at Second City. So like, you know, it doesn't feel like a job. I get to work with like hilarious people who
sounds like a dream job.
Yeah. And again, it's not always easy. And at times it's been tremendously difficult, but you know, I fell into it. I was a dishwasher here and ended up, you know, staying forever. So
fantastic.
One thing I wanted to talk about too, because I, you know, obviously there's so much in the news, especially this week, about China. But one aspect that you talk about with the government is a lack of regulation in the early days, which I think would shock Americans. So tell us about that.
Well, yeah. So one of the things in the book I try and do is set the context of the environment during which Alibaba was born and evolved. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, there were only 8 million internet users when Alibaba was started. I think the per capita income was $800. And there was, you know, pretty much nothing there. And over the following 20 years, the company grew and so did the country. And, you know, to the point where now it's like 1.2 billion internet users. And I think it constitutes 52% of the world's e-commerce. So it's a much different sort of world today. I think the per capita income is about $10,000. So the government in a lot of ways was very laissez-faire to encourage innovation, to encourage kind of development in this sector. What they did provide were things like infrastructure. You had roads, you had, you know, internet connectivity. There was a lot of investment in all of this. So it provided an enabling environment and fertile soil for the rise of, say, e-commerce companies. But other than that, they just had them duke it out. And you know, you had hundreds of you know, e-commerce or maybe even thousands of e-commerce entrants at that time trying to build, you know, marketplaces and different platforms. But it wasn't until later when these businesses started to take more shape and get traction that they started to be regulated. And the truth of the matter is, for a time, they were too small for anyone to care.
Yeah.
You know, and it was really kind of a wait and see. But I think that late touch, so to speak, approach allowed for a lot of innovation to blossom. And obviously, it's a different time now. I think, though, this is kind of a global phenomenon. I mean, you see a lot of regulation in the last 3 years kind of coming into play in China. But you also see a lot of, you know, backlash against big tech in the U.S. and Europe, right? I think we're kind of at that stage where we have to sort of figure out how to manage this.
So I imagine you finished writing this like a year and a half ago, right?
I started it about 2 years ago, and I finished it about maybe 7 months ago. Yeah.
Okay. So in that 7 month time, has anything sort of changed in the way that you would be like, oh, I might add this or end this book differently?
Good question. You know what? Probably there's a lot of things I think I would maybe append or add some commentary. I mean, I think that we're in a more challenging environment, part of the reason you mentioned in terms of regulation, but also in terms of what I think was really, in a lot of ways, you know, this connectivity that the world had between East and West, and a lot of flow of ideas, but also people and commerce, And I think that's starting to really obviously start to become more siloed. I think there's a lot more distrust in the world today. And I think what I would say to that is it's not just going to affect like US and China, but I think it's going to affect the whole world because there's been so much benefit that came from this interconnectedness in places like Southeast Asia, Africa, Latin America. And I was part of that at the, you know, say 2-3 years ago, at the tail end of my time at the company. I saw how people were getting inspired by these models, by getting inspired by the stories and actually creating, you know, prosperity in their local countries using technology. I think my hope is that that doesn't get too disrupted amidst kind of this more geopolitical tension, that we can continue down that road where a lot of these emerging markets, those who have been deprived of the access, will still be able to use this technology to connect with the mainstream kind of economies. Because I think this digital sort of revolution, there's a lot of risks that come with it that I think a lot of people are talking about now, but we shouldn't forget the benefits of what it brings.
Yeah, for sure. So I lost count as to how many times you left, joined and left Alibaba. Three?
Oh, no, yeah.
And you're not there
now. Yeah, I left. No, I'm not. And yeah, I'm not planning to go back anytime soon this round. But I left, I think I left twice. I went back three times.
Okay. So, and it seems like the one thing, the job that you had that seems to me that you were most proud of was in 2016 when Jack asked you to help think about creating a new school. That felt like there was some passion leaping off the page.
You know, I think it was exciting for me because it allowed me to finally take my experience and share it with others to kind of help inspire them to do things that I think, you know, is very meaningful. Really, it's about taking their dreams and ambitions around the use of technology and also affect their communities in the same way that I had been a part of Alibaba doing that for kind of the Chinese, sort of market. And to be able to work with these entrepreneurs and see the impact in their local communities, I think was very powerful for me, particularly in that stage of my career, because I felt like it was a time for me to try and help others as opposed to try and just do, you know, be part of a business and do the daily work there. It was also a great opportunity to kind of share the experience and support them in their endeavors.
And one of the things you talk about that, which is a very improv thing, is this idea of unlearning. So that is a, you come in your first improv class, it's almost all essentially sort of mindfulness type exercises to get you comfortable with the fact that you're going to fail a bunch, to get you out of judgment of self and judgment of others, all those sort of things, again, very Eastern, as well.
Yeah.
But I think sort of essential if you're going to build people, who are going to be top performers. And I don't think we do it enough in any of our businesses.
So the unlearning, a lot of that was, previously held assumptions and also things that I learned, say, in like business school. And what I expected is I could go back to, because I went to business school in between two stints at Alibaba, thinking that what I needed amidst all the chaos happening at the company, I needed to go back to school and learn the right way of doing things and then return to the company and kind of show them how it's done. And one of the things I realized is a lot of the lessons that I learned in business school weren't working in that environment at Alibaba. And so I had Jack's like, why did you go to business school and spend all that money and time? You should have stayed here and you would have learned more. Uh-huh. And, you know, again, like many things that Jack says, it has an element of truth, but you also have to kind of put it in the context. Obviously, an MBA is very useful, but probably at a company that's more developed, more structured, and more mature. And so when I had to unlearn these things, I think it challenged my perceptions of kind of what you needed in life to be successful. Just because you had like the credentials, just because you kind of did the right path, it doesn't always end up kind of in the way that you expect or being turning out the way you expect, because there's so many other scenarios in life that maybe you don't see if you don't step outside your normal sort of comfort zone. And so, yeah, it was a humbling experience, but I think it just kind of taught me more and allowed me to enhance my MBA education. Not that it was, you know, not useful. It just became useful later.
Yeah. Okay. That's a great way of putting it. Before we ask you for a yes and story, what are you doing now?
Yeah. Well, I am actually running a small media platform. And in what the focus is really trying to bridge understanding of cultures, particularly youth culture, in the China region and the West. Mm-hmm. And you know, we focus on things like entertainment, music, art, design, and anything that would be interesting to kind of the millennials and Gen Zs, mm-hmm. From this part of the world, so that they can get a more nuanced understanding of what's happening here on the ground. I think that for me, you can see there's sort of a pattern here, is trying to bridge cultural understanding. Yeah. And do it in a way, I think, first through technology, that was through entrepreneurship, because I think that is a very kind of universal thing. An entrepreneur in America, in Europe, or in Asia is the same kind of animal, because they have to take on such risk and challenges and solve problems, right? And I think when it comes to culture, you know, whether it's music, film, art, it's a universal medium, but it'll allow you to kind of communicate with one another through visual and auditory. And so I'm trying to, you know, help bridge that understanding in this way while I'm here. And what else am I doing? Yeah, I mean, I'm still doing some investment in like startups, because that helps me utilize my past experience in the region. So
yeah. It's interesting. Danny Kahneman talks about seeing the world as a problem that's there to be solved. Yeah. I think Jack says something very similar. And I just wrote down the fact that you're working on cultural understanding and nuance. So if you want to talk about problem in 2022, you are in it. That is problem.
Yes.
Not a lot of nuance. Right. Not a lot of cultural understanding. All right. We always end the program asking for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Okay, so I'll go to the conversation I had with Jack in the final sort of return to Ali before I made the decision. I said, you know, Jack, I'm feeling frustrated with the startup that I'm involved with. Like, what should I do as a next step? And he said, Brian, why don't you go find the poorest part of China, go travel there. Stay in a town or a village for a few days. If you're comfortable, then move on to another place. If you're uncomfortable, then stay longer. I think I wrote about this in the book.
Yep.
And I was thinking, why on earth would anyone want to do that? It's like intentionally going somewhere to find the most like unpleasant experience and just wallow in it. But yeah, and I did it, and it turned out to be quite eye-opening for me, because it allowed me to kind of understand myself better and understand what is important to me in terms of the things that I value and that I feel are important to kind of address, and that helped me kind of come to a decision in terms of what I did next.
Yeah, we obviously – human beings really avoid a lot of discomfort for obvious reasons, but I don't know of any achievement or anything of meaning that didn't arise out of a fair amount of discomfort. And that goes from working out to a relationship to having kids, all that stuff, right? I mean, it's like the bulk of that time is not good or easy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's strange how that works, but you look back on it and you say, "Wow, that was very valuable for my life," you know.
Yeah. The book is called "The Tao of Alibaba: Inside the Chinese Digital Giant That Is Changing the World." Brian Wong, thanks for coming on the pod.
Thanks so much, Kelly.
Getting to Yes And podcast is produced by The Second City and WGN Radio. We are supported at The Second City by Mike Farinaccio and Colleen Fahey. Our show is produced by Andrew Harris at WGN. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of the podcast is by Jukebox The Ghost. If you're interested in knowing more about The Second City, you can log on to secondcity.com or email us at works@secondcity.com.
Survives 10 million feet.